I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. So there wasn't much suspense on the field in last night's Super Bowl with the Seattle Seahawks blowing out the Denver Broncos. But for fans who sit through the football to watch the ads, there was plenty of action. Here to tell us more about the commercial hits and misses is Eric Dagans. He's NPR's TV critic. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what seems to be a fan favorite. Cheerios brought back the adorable interracial family for the Super Bowl. Let's hear a clip.
Hey, Gracie. You know how our family has Daddy and Mommy?
And me.
Yeah, that's right. Pretty soon, you're gonna have a baby brother.
And a puppy.
Deal.
Unfortunately, what you can't see is how she's already perfected the sister neck roll. You know, you can't see her eye, her facial expressions as she's negotiating for that puppy. But one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this one is this sparked, I don't want to say, was it a lot? I mean, the fact that there was any kind of racist comments online at the time that the ad premiered last year, similar reaction this year or not?
Last year, there was a different the same sort of characters were featured in a different ad, and the mother's white, the father's African-American, and they have obviously a biracial child together. And when that ad went online last year, there was a ton of racist comments posted on the YouTube page for the ad, which then led to lots of news stories about those comments, which then led people to really rally around the ad and support it. So now Cheerios has doubled down, and they created a new ad with the same characters. The other thing you can't see is the expression of the mother when the guy, when the father says, "We're getting a puppy." She's like, "Who's going to take care of this?"
Exactly. You know, yes, exactly.
In her face. But what's wonderful is that, again, people have rallied around this ad. It was released early. It got lots of positive publicity. And I think people wanted to make a statement of supporting the ad to show that they feel differently than some of these people who posted stuff online about it.
But speaking of posting stuff online, another ad that got a lot of attention was Coca-Cola's America the Beautiful ad.
Beautiful for spacious skies.
Por tus olas de granos tan bar.
Your peach in the tzakote.
Sa ibabaw ng mga prutas.
America.
We're hearing America the Beautiful sung in Spanish. We're hearing it sung in Tagala and in Hindi. So we're hearing it in many different languages while we're seeing this wide diversity of people. And the message is simple. You know, America's strength comes from its diversity. But on one side, you had people who were strongly resisting this ad. And then you had what seemed to be a larger number of people really supportive of the message. And they were warring on Twitter and social media.
Do you feel that this will result in any larger story?
The whole struggle when one of these controversy kicks off, and we saw it with the Cheerios ad too, is how much of the negative backlash is people who are just kind of trolls out there, who are kind of undesirable and marginal and they don't amount to much? Or is the negative reaction very significant, and does it reflect the views of a significant portion of Americans? And I think that's the question that Coke is going to face in the days and weeks to come. Now, what we've seen in some of the ad analyses that people like USA Today and others do is that the ad scored high and people liked it. So even if there was a significant number of people who were outraged by it, it seems like there were many more people who liked it. Certainly judging by what I saw on Twitter, what I saw in my own Twitter stream, people retweeting the ad and retweeting comments that I made that were supportive of the ad, and also looking at the Facebook page of Coca-Cola. So certainly that's what Coke is going to be looking at to try and judge whether or not this was a success.
Again, more news around the commercials than perhaps around the game. But before we let you go, there was one other ad you wanted to mention. Tell us about it.
We saw a mini Seinfeld reunion. I mean, for a fan of TV, you got to love this. We had heard news reports in the week before that Jerry Seinfeld and that the fellow who plays George Costanza, Jason Alexander, and Larry David, the executive producer of Seinfeld, that they had gotten back together again, and they had filmed something at the iconic Tom's Diner where the characters from Seinfeld always used to get together when the show was actually on the air. So we found out during the Super Bowl that there was a promotional spot for Jerry Seinfeld's online series called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. And so finally, we got to see Jerry and George and their nemesis Newman face off together on television one more time.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Audie Cornish, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. And we start today with this question. What's in a voice? To the folks at Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia, a voice apparently means a lot. They've begun a project to archive the voices of famous people.
I said, gee, I like this part. No, that's the lead. You're a character juvenile, which meant you were
the writer must face the fact that ordinary lives are what most people live most of the
time. One of my favorite symbols of hope is a very long feather from the wing of the California.
We had to go through the line of soldiers, and many of them, their hands were shaking. I don't think they particularly wanted to shoot us down.
Those voices, actor Dustin Hoffman, writer John Updike, scientist Jane Goodall, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, are among the audio clips now found in Wikipedia's biographical entries. Here to explain more is the project's brainchild Wikipedia expert Andy Mabbitt. Welcome to the program.
Hello, and good afternoon, America.
So first off, where did this idea come from? Why do this?
Well, being English, it happened in a pub. I was talking to a friend after a Wikipedia conference in London, and he mentioned that he wanted to get more sound files onto Wikipedia. And he was meaning things like engines running and the sound of running water at a waterfall and so on. And I said it would be a good idea to get people's voices too. I wrote a blog post suggesting that we get some people to record their voices for Wikipedia and asked everybody I knew who was the subject of a Wikipedia article to provide a short sample where they tell us their name and a little bit about their background so we know what their voices sound like. As a result of that, the BBC heard the project and they asked me if I would get involved in a similar project that they were about to run where they've open licensed or released with permission for reuse up to 1,000 40-second clips of programs from their archive. Mm. They realize those clips are also useful for us on Wikipedia to exemplify how people sound.
And this project, you describe it first, is essentially the voice introduction project. Here's a sample of one of those.
Hello, my name is Stephen Fry. I was born in London, and I've been in the entertainment business since, I suppose about 1981.
So British actor Stephen Fry, and he and others basically just introduced themselves. What do we learn from someone, other than their name and what they do, from introductions and the way they go about introducing themselves?
Well, the name Stephen is fairly obvious. Most of us know how to pronounce it. But imagine you're not from a Western culture and you see that written down with a PH in the middle, Stephen. You wouldn't know how to pronounce it. So if we get people to tell us their name, we know how they pronounce it, which is pretty much the definitive guide.
And then also, why the choice of audio versus video?
There's nothing wrong with video, and we use video on Wikipedia as well. But by using audio, it's a very small ask of the person who's recording their voice for us. They can do it in the morning when they're in their dressing gown and curlers. They don't have to dress up smart for it like they would with video. Some people are shy of appearing in front of a camera. But it's also a small file to transmit over the internet. So if you're on a low bandwidth connection or you pay by the megabyte, it's a lot cheaper to download the audio than the video.
Now, when it comes to the human voice, I mean, what is it that you think people are learning here from hearing someone's voice? I don't know if there's a person in particular that struck you in the past, but what are we getting here besides simply what they sound like?
It's a very personal thing. If you think about the people in your own life, you know their voice the moment you hear it, as much as, or sometimes even more so than a photograph. Sometimes you can look at a photograph from 20 years ago and think, is that my partner or neighbor or friend, or is that just somebody who looks like them? With the voice, you know instantly. And I don't know about you, but personally, if I hear a voice from the dim and distant past, from the days of wax cylinder recording, somebody like the nurse Florence Nightingale, it's so exciting to have that connection back to them. And so we're doing the same for people today.
Now, how do you verify that the audio is real, especially since folks will upload the audio themselves?
We have a series of processes for checking things like that. I'm not going to go into too much detail about some of them because I don't want to tempt forgery. But we ask people to verify their ownership of the audio recording by email. And we can obviously trace back who that email belonged to. For a notable person, you can cross-reference it with their agent or something like that.
Before I let you go, do you have a wish list? Is there a voice or two that you really want to hear that you've never heard before that you really just want to have part of the project?
Well, I happen to know there's a Wikipedia article about you. So I'm looking forward to receiving your recording order, I'm afraid. I'm sure you know how to do it by now.
I'll work on that. I can say my name at least.
No fear or favour. I'm pleased for anybody who's a subject of a Wikipedia article, whether they sound like a Shakespearean actor or a guy on the corner of the street selling a newspaper. We want their voice.
Andy Mabbitt, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Andy Mabbitt, a Wikipedia expert, he spoke to us about Wikipedia's Voice Introduction Project. Finally, in tech today, an app to keep you guessing. Or, if you're former Jeopardy champ Ken Jennings, a trivia app called Quiz Up to keep you answering confidently.
I was surprised to find that I was very good at Disney. I patted myself on the back for that.
But even Ken Jennings has a few trivia blind spots.
If you ever play Name the Artist and you're against some novice with a vaguely Jeopardy-themed name, that might be me if you're kicking my butt.
The Quiz Up app is a game you play with other users, from strangers in another country to friends just a few feet away. The topics range from important moments in history to literature.
Crime fiction, 50 Shades of Grey, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
To music.
There's a Britney Spears category, there's a Bowie category, Justin Bieber. Oh, I got to do that one.
Well, we asked Ken Jennings to play a round of Quiz Up in real time, using a category he knew little about. Here's a hint.
Say it.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
Jennings wasn't, and he sent us this app review.
So I'm going to choose Twilight. I'm playing someone named Terry at Twilight Trivia, and the questions come fast. The only female wolf in the Killayute pack. I guessed Leah, and I guessed right. Oh, and Terry got it wrong. Terry, why are you playing Twilight Trivia if you don't know this kind of stuff? What is Edward's middle name? You gotta be kidding me. I'm gonna go Edward James. Oh, I got it wrong. It's Anthony, and Terry knew it. I'm wasting my life. What is Edward's condition for changing Bella into a vampire? 5 years of waiting, maybe? Oh, I thought that book was all about the sex waiting. Marriage, apparently. Even better. Marriage. The other option was Attending Dartmouth. That would be a good book. The first human with whom Bella interacts outside her family. I don't know any of these people. I said Max. Oh, and I got it right! But guess what? Terry was a little faster than me and wins by 2 points. That was intense. Man, my heart rate's a little too high for public radio right now. QuizUp is a very strong app. I've played a lot of trivia games, and it avoids all the bugaboos. The questions are smart and clever, and so far I haven't seen one that's wrong. There's hundreds of categories, hundreds of thousands of questions, so you don't see a lot of duplicates. You go up against some very smart people in whatever kind of quiz you like. I would recommend QuizUp wholeheartedly, and I'm actually playing right now. I'm 0-1 at Twilight. I'm going to run this back. I'm going to get a rematch against Terry.
That's former Jeopardy champ Ken Jennings with today's app review of Quiz Up. He's also the author of the children's book series Junior Genius Guides.
You can follow All Tech Considered on Twitter at NPR All Tech, and you can find us there as well. I'm Melissa Block at NPR Melissa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish at NPR Audie. Our colleague Robert is at rsiegel47. And the Twitter feed for the whole program is at NPR ATC.
The Danish television series Borgen, about a female party leader who unexpectedly becomes Denmark's prime minister, was a hit in its home country and in the United Kingdom. It won numerous international prizes and a cult following in the U.S. after its sporadic TV broadcasts. Stephen King named it his favorite piece of pop culture of 2012. The third and final season has just been released on DVD. Our critic at large, John Power, says he downed Borgen in great gulps, and he describes it as irresistibly bingeable.
I've spent most of my life being fascinated by politics. But Washington has grown so stridently dysfunctional, I can barely stand to watch the news. And though I enjoy shows like Veep and House of Cards, they're so devoutly cynical they almost feel like part of the problem. As an antidote to this, I highly recommend Borgen, the crest of the current wave of Danish TV that's given us The Killing and The Bridge. Taking its name from the Copenhagen castle that's the seat of government, Borgen plays like a more astringent version of The West Wing, a show it clearly borrows from and improves on. Its third and final season is just out on DVD, but you'll want to start at the very beginning, which instantly sucks you into the world of Danish politics, with its idealists and ideologues, sleazy tabloids and state-run TV networks, bullying billionaires, and fussy bureaucrats with minds of their own. Borgen's heroine is Birgitte Nyberg, superbly played by Sidse Babette Knudsen, the principled low-key leader of the moderate party. As the series begins, this happily married mother of two rides a freakish turn of events to become Denmark's first woman prime minister. But taking office is one thing. Knowing how to govern is another. Starting each episode with an aphorism from the likes of Machiavelli, Churchill, or Chairman Mao, Borgen shows us Birgitte learning how to run the machinery of power, how to slap down a foe and fire an ally, when to go on TV and when to rise above the fray, when to compromise and when to be steely. Here, she's talking to the brutal dictator of an ex-Soviet republic who's threatening to cancel a huge business deal with Denmark if she doesn't hand over a dissident named Bayanov who's visiting her country. Although the show's in Danish with subtitles, here they speak their common language, English.
What will happen to Bayanov if we hand him over?
Let's not discuss that on a day of celebration like this.
I can't hand him over if you won't tell me.
My dear Prime Minister, it's up to Turkizian people and the Turkizian legal system to decide.
I mean, no offense, Mr. President, but I really need to know more than that.
Let me ask you a question. Why do you consider yourself a better and more democratic leader than I?
Why would you ask me that?
Oh, I think you know. How old is Danish democracy? 160 years? Ours is 20 years old. It takes time, Mrs. Prime Minister. It takes time. Turkizian people not used to being asked, they are used to being told. It is in the DNA of my people to obey the leader.
So if I understand you correctly, it is you, isn't it, Mr. President, who will decide what will happen to Bayanov?
Are we playing games, Mrs. Prime Minister?
I hope not. There's a man's life at stake here.
Well, when our democracy is 160 years old, we can talk. Until then, I will not take any more arrogant lessons from you.
Of course, Birgitte doesn't live in the world alone. Part of what makes Borgen so enjoyable is that it surrounds her with maybe 20 vividly drawn regulars, from the smug opposition leader Hesselbo to the alcoholic old reporter Hanna Holm. Chief among them are Birgitte's spin doctor Kasper Yule, a Don Draperish sort who learned how to spin as a way of camouflaging his dark past. And the woman he loves, Katrine Fonsmark. She's a sexy but idealistic reporter who has a poster of all the president's men on the door of her apartment. Like Birgitte, both are trying to figure out how to be honest in a world where press secretaries must weasel and reporters must answer to corrupt editors or TV execs who curry the government's favor. I'm not sure I've ever seen a show that's better at capturing the personal cost of political life. For Birgitte, power doesn't so much corrupt as isolate. The more successful she becomes as PM, the more her private world dwindles. Her circle of friends shrinks, her children feel neglected, and her marriage to the funny liberal-minded Philip, a one-time CEO who's put his career on hold, starts to founder. Losing her knack for intimacy, she begins talking to him like a prime minister making points in a cabinet meeting. Now, I realize that the thought of a Danish cabinet meeting may not exactly make your mouth water. But believe me, the show has plenty to grip an American viewer. For starters, it gives a keen glimpse at how the Danes view us. They're pro-American, yet as a small country, they're often resentful at the way the U.S. can act like the 800-pound gorilla, as when the CIA secretly uses a Danish base for illegal rendition. Beyond this, the issues Birgitte confronts each week are the same ones we face. How to manage immigration, how to assure both security and privacy, how to keep a social safety net in a world where one's rising economic competitors cut costs by not having one. In tackling such issues, Birgitte is clearly an idealized figure. Yet Borgen makes it clear that even a virtuous politician can't be as decent as she'd like. Birgitte backs proposals she doesn't quite believe in to enact bigger policies that she does. She works with ministers she'd like to fire but keeps on because it would cost her too much to can them. And she's loyal to her old friends until she has to sacrifice them when they've become a liability. The show doesn't falter for this. Quite the contrary. Borgen reminds us what it's easy to forget in these polarized times, that no political decision is ever pure or simple, and that it's childish to think otherwise.
John Powers writes about film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the Danish TV series Borgen. All three seasons have been released on DVD by MHZ Networks.
Tonight, we'll be saying goodbye to a guy who is leaving his job at the top of his game. Again.
A couple weeks ago, President Obama called me, told me personally, if I like my current job, I can keep my current job. Well, and I believe it. Yeah, I believe it.
That's Jay Leno making a joke about the president and himself. Leno is hosting his last Tonight Show tonight. A younger, hipper guy is going to take over. And here to talk about this move, NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, good morning.
Good morning.
So this all seems a little familiar.
It surely does. We saw this happen again, once again in 2009, 2010, when NBC gave the Tonight Show to Conan O'Brien. They mm-hmm. were trying to keep him at the network. And to hold on to Leno as well, they gave him a show at 10 p.m. across weeknights. And the ratings for both those shows did so badly that when the dust cleared, Leno was back in the Tonight Show, and it hurt his image a little bit.
It's amazing to think of everything he's been through. I mean, he went through that sort of shuffle, came back, is on The Tonight Show for this run. Now he's leaving. And, I mean, he's been hosting longer than anyone else except Johnny Carson. And a lot of people remember, I mean, Carson had this huge emotional goodbye with a lot of big guests. Leno, it seems like he's almost quietly walking off the stage. Why is it different?
Jay Leno is kind of like the Rodney Dangerfield of late night hosts in a way. He's been successful for really long, but I think people don't give him credit in part because critics like me say that he's pandered to a middle America audience. He's not considered hip by people on the coast. And also there was all this conflict and controversy over how he got the Tonight Show back from Conan O'Brien. And I think NBC just wants to avoid all of that. And in this transition, you see Jay Leno trying to be the good soldier. He's really trying to say all the right things. And in fact, when we saw him do an interview on 60 Minutes, one of the few interviews he's done, you really get that sense he's trying to be the good soldier. Let's listen to a clip.
I think I probably would have stayed if we didn't have an extremely qualified young guy ready to jump in. If they said, look, you're fired. We don't know who we're going to get, but anybody but you, we just want you out of it. I would be hurt and offended. But this makes perfect sense.
Yeah, he's handling it so gracefully, it sounds like. But critics like you, you say, I mean, you treat him, I mean, it is Rodney Dangerfield. He just doesn't get respect.
Exactly. And Jay Leno was always considered a comics comic, a guy who even Jerry Seinfeld, who's considered one of the best stand-up comics, said that Jay Leno was his comedy mentor. But I think there's also a sense that this guy kind of tamped down his more dangerous spirit, his more edgy comedy sense in order to be successful. He was always very concerned about having the working class guy, the average guy, really enjoy his comedy. But it also took some of the danger out of it.
Jimmy Fallon is taking over, and he strikes me as a guy who is not going to tone things down and might be a little edgier than we've seen from Jay Leno.
Well, but Jimmy Fallon also has that likable quality. He's everybody's best friend. And he's also a guy who has captured the millennial spirit in his comedy. So it's going to be great to see him bring a rap band to late night. It's going to be great to see him show how viral videos play and all of his great impressions. So it'll be a different Tonight Show, but it also will be, I think, a very welcoming one.
Well, assuming we don't see what happened before, Leno actually coming back once again, do we know what Jay Leno's going to do next?
Nope. CNN may be interested. The History Channel may be interested. Certainly, he has a lot of options.
All right. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks for talking to us as always.
Thanks a lot for having me.